I was invited to do some work in the Project Arts Centre in Dublin. I think it was probably, I can't remember exactly, early in the year. Certainly it wasn't very warm. It was in a terrible state because it had just been opened. It was going to be refurbished in some way. And a number of artists had been invited to work with it in the state that it was in, which was I rather liked the idea of it. Anyway, I looked around the space, and just inside the door was this quite a large space, and concrete floor and so on, and puddles and because of leaks in the roof and so on. And the previous weekend they'd had an enormously successful pop rock festival with a lot of people coming from Belfast and so on, and the evidence of this gigantic event was sort of strewn all over this building, and it was like an abandoned kind of industrial hulk, really. And it was a cold and hard sort of introduction to the whole thing, and the work was in a way, very much of was reflected the sort of rather tough conditions that that were there, that I experienced there. I got the feeling that there was a certain not animosity but certainly a distancing. I felt that I wasn't a popular, that British artists weren't going to be popular in Dublin. I mean, we don't need to discuss the reasons why, they're so obvious. But certainly I felt that very much. So not only was it hard and cold in terms of the actual thing, it was also, in psychological terms, it was difficult. and I suppose the work itself every time I look at the work, that's what I see, really, this sort of rather tough and difficult situation. Anyway, the space that I decided to work in was this kind of rather large, well, not too big, maybe 40 feet one dimension and maybe 20 to 30 in the other, with a double doors going out onto the street on one side of it. And I really use certain elements which have recurred in previous works, in another kind of way. That is, one, the change from black to white, or this sort of conflict of black and white, in visual terms, the movement from either wet to dry or dry to wet. And in the suspension of the figure off the ground, into a groundless state, and the water on the floor, in a way representing a kind of instability, like a change of surface. And in this work, something was added, which was the two chairs tied together and hanging from the iron beams, but in a certain way that when one hanging maybe 12 feet down and coming down above the floor, maybe a foot above the floor, so that if I lay on the ground and these two chairs swung backwards and forwards across the room, the bottom of the chair would just be, as close as possible to my body without touching it. And on the chair was tied a hundredweight sack of flour. And there was a lot of water poured onto the floor. And the activity was between me lying on the ground in the water with this weight of two chairs and sack swinging across the room and just sort of touching me as it went over, but not swinging in a a symmetrical form, because I tied it in a certain way so that it would swing and catch some metal up there, and then it would tend to swing not eccentrically all the time, but it would break its predictable path and then swing another way and so forth. And I would get that, part of the work was to get that swinging in motion. It would keep going for quite a long time, and then as the thing swung out of the center of the room towards one side, I would then dive onto the floor to the point where it would swing back, so that I would be laying on the floor and this thing would swing right down and just sort of miss me. And then there were other actions where I would be in the room standing or moving, and this thing would be swinging, this 100-weight sack would be swinging through the room, and I would try to be in a position where it would just miss me. But then, because of this eccentric action, it was slightly difficult, because it was a bit like having, obviously not like having a wild bull, but it had an aspect of that, because one couldn't always quite tell where it was coming. It had that element of danger about it. It did knock me around once or twice, but only once or twice. And then the other part of it, of that at a certain stage I then cut the sack.
Yeah.
And then as the thing swung, so the flower would come out and would change the whole surface colour and feeling of the floor. I mean, where there was a lot of water, obviously it would sort of sink into it and so forth and remain wet. But there were large areas where it would just make a kind of dry, whitish surface. And that would happen until all of the flour was out of the sack, and then the danger of this object was far less, because there was much less weight, and it was like a gigantic sort of, I saw it as a kind of not just a protagonist, but a sort of an authority with restricted, predictable, and then some slight unpredictable moves actions, in which that one had to be very wary of and keep out of the way of. And the other part of this was actually the suspension of the body in air, as it were. I can't sort of rationalize what that is, how that works in relation to the weight and but it was a kind of counterpoint to the structure, this weighted thing in some way, and that the rope was up about, I suppose, 6 feet, 8 feet, something like that, and I could get into a position where I could stay up there for some time. It actually gets very painful on ropes, they bite into you, and trying to create that circumstance so that when somebody came into the room, there would be a figure upside down in space, as it were, like in the wrong position for a human being in a space.
Was there a consideration here, either consciously or unconsciously, that this was taking place in Ireland?
Well, yes, there was. I mean, but I can't say that concern is sort of reproduced in the work.
Yeah.
One couldn't point to any particular element in the work, I think, and say, well, that is because. unlike the work I did in 1972 at the Icon Gallery, which was called You Know It Makes Sense. I think I did two or three pieces of work based on two, I think. And You Know It Makes Sense was a slogan used by Harold Wilson in one of those election manifestos in the early 70s. And the You Know It Makes Sense in at the Icon was a piece of work that was devised around the issue of torture. That was alleged to have been carried out by British troops in Northern Ireland. So at that point there was definitely a specific recognition, if you like, of the political, not political, of the um, well, it is political in one sense, of the effect of a military presence, you know, in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, and my reaction to it, to that information, which came out of the Irish Times, I think, and then went to the
Sunday
Times.
And what work did you make?
It was to do with a kind of very alienating series of actions with a number of people, again with suspension involved, again it's difficult to describe. I mean, in a way, they obviously relate. When I look at it now, I see that they relate. I didn't imagine they related before. But since there were more people, there were two women and two men, the imagery is relatively different, because one works in relation to other people. When one's on one's own, then it's, there you are. Yeah. You've got to deal with it. You know, one can't sort of work off anybody else, play off another person.
Sure.
The same alienating device is the use of chairs, suspension and so forth. And in the Birmingham piece, where sort of hoods were used, you know, those things they put hoods over people's heads, subjected to noise and so forth. You know, certain devices like that. And there was nothing illustrational about it at all. It was done in recognition that was alleged to be taking place. But I couldn't say with this that, you know, there was anything specific like that, you know, about this piece of work, even though those two pieces of work relate.
I suppose the difficulty about making overtly political sort of art is that the actual power of the political intention and message is what is being responded to in a kind of journalistic sense, but to actually make art that embodies and expresses a kind of a concern is something that perhaps much more elusive and ultimately more important. But I certainly feel that there is, you know, a strong statement being made about the individual and the hostility of an environment, maybe, which one can then say, well, you know, yes, it is political, and yes, it is to do with Ireland, but in a fundamental sense, and it's also to do with other conflicts.
I had actually a lot of interest in the Irish situation. When I first went, I had a lot of opinions. You know, I had opinions about it. I have far fewer opinions about it now. You know, about the state of Ireland and so on and so forth. A certain number of, I guess, some views about it. So by the time I did this, I had been aware of or been involved in the sort of Irish thing, the going to Ireland and so forth, for about 8-9 years. So I was sufficiently aware to know that it wasn't simple, and that one couldn't that there's no simple way that one can actually make any statement about it at all.
Sure.
And therefore, you know, I was very reluctant to try to make any kind of over. But I would also be reluctant to do it anywhere. You know, it's not a question of Ireland. It's a question of, I mean, I'm very suspicious of those kind of overtly political statements, which are then attempting to. Which are then attempted to be forced into an art mode, and I rather agreed with friends of mine in Belfast that who took a certain position in relation to as artists, in relation to people coming from outside making statements about the Irish situation, notably Boyce and one or two other people. And being very resentful of the ease with which people could come from abroad and pronounce on the state of the nation or whatever they were thinking they were doing, and I very much agree with them about that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it's far too easily done, you know, and is eventually rather destructive. Most people, as far as I can see, who do performance, do a performance at a specific time. You know, like X will perform at 8 p.m. and at 9 p.m. it is over, or at 10 p.m. it's over, 11 p.m. There must be exceptions to that other than me. My problem is that I'm actually evolving a piece of work in public where the value of any part of it is really open to question as to whether it attains any kind of level of meaning or not. And when it attains that level of meaning is not something that I can actually I can't say, you know, that if you come, I'm doing this work between the hours of, say, 2 and 5 for 4 days, any individual who comes at any point during that time will see a work which actually has meaning.
Yeah.
Because I can't do it. Maybe I'm limited, I just can't do it. Neither can I say, well, if you come at 3:30, it's liable to have meaning.
I suppose the actual process of trying to attain something that has meaning, if you like, is therefore important.
Yeah. Also, what happens is that it, I think I've done enough of these things now to know that there are always people who are very sympathetic to that problem. They see the sort of the frailty, and they're sympathetic to the issue, to the whole problem.
You know,
that you're not, yes, because one's not actually sort of presenting something like. I mean, I've got nothing against. I'm actually rather. I mean, I don't want to say you. I'm going to use a phrase to do with theatre, but not by implication damning the theatre at all. A piece of theatre tends to have been organised and is then produced, right, and it rises or falls according to a particular performance thing, level of articulation and acting at that time, you know, one night as opposed to another, one afternoon as opposed to another. But with this, it's actually taking, it's starting a new work in completely, and so inevitably it's going to show all the frailties and all the faults and all the kind of banalities that occur in making a work. Now there are people. I think the implication behind that is really very important.
Yeah.
Actually, that one is doing that in sort of social terms. Really, I suppose, whether it's social terms, I suppose it is. That you know, there isn't an elevation, an implied elevation, that here is a person doing something to other people from an elevated position. It's somebody actually trying to raise something up in the presence of other people. The presence of other people being very important that happens, because there's no way that I can raise the level of anything if there's nobody there in a live work. So the presence of other people is critical to the thing raising itself in the first place. So it becomes, in some ways, a kind of collaboration, even if people are merely standing.
Yeah.
You know, they actually form we all know that somebody can stand in a room and give off, you know, sort of really aggressive. I mean, people that stand with sympathy. You know, standing with sympathy means that you have the possibility of the thing really working. Without that, nothing happens.
So I'm reminded almost of the idea of a ritual,
yeah,
which can't take place,
yeah,
in isolation, and,
yeah,
and it is a participatory, yeah, event in a way.
There is something else that's begun to creep in, or has been creeping in, which is, I don't know if it's a side issue or not, I don't really think it is, and that is that the camera can actually stand for the audience in this way. It can work to the camera. But the presence of the camera is actually quite important. Sometimes it becomes more important than,
sure,
the person, because it represents a certain sort of future. I mean, in a film that I'm making with Ken, you know, part of the a large part of the problem of the film is how one approaches subjects with camera.
Yeah.
And what happens, and the, you know, the, especially in relation to, you know, performance and so forth. What is what documentation is, for example? You know, what role can the camera play? The camera obviously is very influential, it seems to me, in relation to performance. In the way that, certainly in the way that, that I, if I am a representative of a particular kind of performance, the camera is critical to that. If there wasn't a camera, I suspect I wouldn't be, this work would be different.
I suppose that, that there have been negative criticisms about documenting performances, i.e. that the performance has only been made for the documentation, but really the positive side of the documentation is that it's made to anticipate a future audience.
Yeah. I think there's a question that, about the word documentation anyway. My sort of common everyday understanding of the word documentation is that it's that it should be objective. You know, if it's a documentary film or something, then it is in some ways objective. I mean, it's maybe related to one's, you know, notions about balance of the BBC and all of that, and the attempt to create, you know, something which tells truth in some way. Because there's nothing to do with the truth in that way. It's all it is a construction, right? It's a construction resulting from certain preconceptions. And there's no neutral position that one can take in relation to documentation, it seems to me. Therefore, one should really abandon the notion,
sure,
you know, that there's anything objective about it. I found that it... I don't know whether I think like this now or feel like this now, but then, and before then as well, I was thinking, the problem of actually doing something in front of other people was the problem for me. I didn't want to be a performer. I didn't want to do that. So I suppose I in the work in Montreal, I tried to, in a way, hand it all over to the audience, you know, and say, well, you know, like, I'm not it, you're it. What I did was to take to sets of chairs and to set, if you imagine that as being the one set of chairs at a diagonal, actually I think they went that way. One set of chairs that way, facing people facing into the corner of the room there. Another set of chairs facing that way, with people facing that way into the room. If you imagine it's 100 yards long, you know, it's quite a distance between them. And chairs for 100 people there, and chairs for 100 people there. And the work started, like all the other works, from scratch, with there, you know, being nothing except me and the audience. And the title of the work was The One and the Other in the Attic of Poverty. And the Attic of Poverty was, in fact, when I first got to Montreal, I wanted to find some clothes to wear for this work. And so I wanted to go to second-hand shops, you know, to places like Salvation Army and all those sorts of places. And I found out, I heard of this place called the Attic of Poverty, which was a second-hand shop. It was a knockout name. And we walked the whole length of Montreal from one end to the other in the snow, you know, to find this place, the Attic of Poverty. And it was just absolutely useless. I mean, it was a terrible little shop that was, you know, had like nothing in it. It had an extraordinarily imaginative name, but nothing else, you know. And it took us about 3 hours to walk there, you know. So it became a, you know, but it was the name that was. So I got something much better. I got the name, it became the title. And the one and the other. This obviously goes back to A and B. And the one was like the person who dealt with the past, and the other was the person who was enacting the present. And therefore represented some sort of future. I mean, I don't want to get into it any further than that. That's how it was sort of rather flatly put out. And at one angle, coming If the chairs were diagonally facing into a corner of the room like that, there was a projector coming this way, facing into the other corner of the room or to the side of the wall, with all of the slides of my, not all, some of the slides of previous works. But they were all facing at an angle, upwards and out of focus. So, and they were going on when I chose them to go on. And they were a deflection. They were a representation of the sort of deflection and the kind of the fact that one is always being tangential. You know, like if we knew if we all knew what was really important, we could go straight at it.
Yeah.
But none of us really do, and we're all kind of being tangential about everything. So it was about the deflection that we take, you know, around serious question of living, you know what I mean, that sort of thing. Mm. And the other thing, these other figures go facing that way, so I was in between this, you know, and this was all about the past, and what I tried to do was persuade the people in the audience that in fact history was being made, that they didn't have to watch it, they didn't have to witness it, because I was the keeper of the, I was the curator of anything that happened, and I could tell them, and they just didn't need to experience it. If you see what I mean, they could have everything, they could have it all, but only by second hand. The attempt was to, first of all, to deny those people who wanted to come to and look at a spectacle, you know, because it seemed to me a spectacle is something that I really, at that time, didn't want to put on, as it were. I didn't want to be a spectacle or to, you know, become a spectacle, you know, for people, and they go away and they're entertained, and, you know, that seemed to me not interesting for this particular thing I did in Montreal. So the problem was how to start this piece of work. Firstly, I really didn't quite know which direction it was going in. It's sort of like an intuitive thing. It had its title, the one and the other in the Attic of Poverty, and it was all had a lot to do with banality. I mean, the historical aspect of it was, you know, the bit that I talked about earlier. As the curator of history, I was the one. It was all about banality, really. Mm. You know, like factual information about the past, which is, as we've talked about earlier, you know, it's not quite what it seems, and hence the deflection and so forth. And I was relating this a lot to listening to the news or watching the news on television or, you know, like reading a newspaper. I mean, great events in history are going on all the time, and very few of us are there, you know, but we all have that impression that we're living in great times, let's say, you know, like Mrs. Thatcher meets Reagan, you know. But, you know, what does that actually mean? You know, what kind of value does it have when I read it and think, wow, you know, Mrs. Thatcher is meeting Reagan?
How are you actually curating the historical information?
I wasn't actually dealing with any information. Mm. I was really only saying, I am the curator, if you see what I mean. And then discussing with people what that meant. What did it mean to deal with history? What was history? You know, how is it made? That sort of thing. And then I also had some other information. You know, I looked out of the window and I saw an old lady standing at the other side of the road who was a down and out, right? And I had written a lot of material about the down and outs around here. Now, so I drew in that material, you know, I mean, this was one, the other, and the Attic of Poverty. It allowed me, that umbrella, to actually use that material that I had picked up out in the street here, people passing, in relation to the woman who was, you know, down in the street below. And I could draw that in, if you like, as a form of documentation, of documented history. But it did break the audience, if you see what I mean. The audience, or the notion of the audience, changed. As I think this, you know, with these kinds of works, or people who expect it, as an audience might expect, are bound to be disappointed and go. It's people who actually have another kind of curiosity, another kind of sympathy, who move into the work and actually help make it. And this is very true in Montreal. You know, people were very responsive to making the work with me. And I think this is part of this. It obviously stems, in a way, it's all circumstantial, maybe, that I am invited to Montreal and I go to Montreal. What do I go with? You know, what am I faced with? What do you do? So you're actually thrown back on yourself. Everywhere you go and in Montreal is new. You know, I mean, okay, it looks the same as anywhere else, but, you know, it's a new, fresh situation. And therefore, to go and do a work, it's difficult to go and do a work which actually isn't in some ways reliant upon the past. And I suppose the problem of history was my recognition of the fact that in any new work that is done, whether it's here or anywhere, one starts from a known position, even though one has aspirations of doing a new work or doing something new or doing something fresh. It's inevitable that it's actually rooted in the past. And when it's rooted in the past, it tends to be banal, if you see what I mean. And it's only when it raises itself up above that, you know, and becomes unique in the present that it begins to work, seems to me. I mean, this is true with any sort of, I certainly remember this as a painter, and every time one is caught with it, because it all sounds all very nice, and I know that the next piece of work I'll do will start like that. I know that there'll be times when I'll think, ah yes, I'm going to do this. Now the reason I won't actually admit it to myself, but really the reason I'm going to do that is because it was successful. At some point, and it might fill in a gap that I can't face now. And as soon as I do that, it's wrong, you know. I continually repeat that problem, you know, that mistake. Because it's not being able to face the present, you know, like being able to take the risk. After I'd been to Montreal, I went to Rotterdam, and I worked with Ian Robertson, again with this notion of the audience. And that was... that was much more formalised and much more, it was much shorter anyway, it was about an hour long. I didn't know how long it was going to be, but it was. And the audience were chairs were put out in this room. It's another big room, not nowhere near as big as the one in Montreal. Chairs put out, and they were all faced different directions, four different directions. So the first chair would face that way, the next one would be at right angles to it. Next one at right angles to it, the next one at right angles to it, like that, so that they rotated, as it were. And they were all, you know, if that one was like that, then the one behind it would be like that, and the one behind it, and so on and so forth. So they were all, every chair was in a different position to another chair. And half of them were on wooden boxes, and half of them were on the floor. So that when 59 people were invited in, and then the doors were shut, and they were invited to sit on the chairs. That meant that half of them could sit up high and the other half could sit down low. And they could make that choice, more or less, until they came to the end, maybe, and then whatever was left was left. And the structure of the work was that every 10 minutes I opened another door at the other end of the room, and anybody who wanted to leave was invited to leave. And then those, exactly the same number that had left, were then invited in from... front part, right, so that one always had, so long as there were people who wanted to come in, 59 people sitting on these boxes, sitting on these chairs, on these boxes. And we then had different periods. Each period of 10 minutes had a different theme, like dream. This is a dream period, this is a talking period, this is a silent period, you know, this is a discussion period.
You orchestrated the...
Yes, we're very sort of, and all the time I was doing that, and all the time Robertson was very quietly going round, countermanding everything I did, but only one to one, you know, like, So that there was this kind of undermining influence at work, but only sort of silently and secretly. And the thing was that they, because, you know, like it was a totally ironic thing. I mean, one was actually trying to get them to, first of all, one set up a rigid system, which is enough to inhibit anyone from doing anything. And secondly, trying to get them to react against it. But at the same time appearing to enforce it. It eventually got a crisis point. Like, for example, we had a 10-minute discussion period and no one said a word. It was absolute silence. You know, so the very title, you know, discussion, became really ironic. And then people started to react. And at some point, Robertson and I had a fight right in the middle of it. This great sort of, like, the conflict actually resolved itself in this fight. And we then, which was real, I mean, it wasn't a... I mean, I don't mean it was outside of the work. You know, it wasn't that we suddenly had a fight. It was the fight was part of the work, but it wasn't something that we'd actually agreed we would do. But the circumstances got to such a pitch that we resolved the conflict in a fight and then went to either end of the room and started screaming at each other and shouting. But as one shouted at the other, so half the audience thought that this person was talking and they began to answer back. So the whole thing became confused, and then it broke down into a discussion, you see, because they all got released through this fight, that they could, you know, half of them could leave and the other, and they could move their chairs, and, you know, the whole thing sort of moved into another kind of state and went into a discussion and so on and so forth, which went on for about 4 hours, you know, they lasted about 4 hours. But that was a much more sort of, that was much more formalized approach to break down, you know, this separation between, you know, the people generating the work and people coming to look at it, you know, by forcing them to be it in some way.
I suppose it reminds one of if you're standing at a bus stop and people don't talk to each other, but then suddenly something happens on the other side of the road and people will turn and start...
Yeah.
Talking. The facts of the sort of thing. Mm. I was going to say that the actual activity of talking to the audience is something that one has witnessed in quite a lot of your works, even the works that are more spectacle oriented.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
you haven't ruled that out as a possibility.
When I first started performance, for the first two or three times, I was too frightened to say anything. But then I began to realise that I wanted to use language, and I did, you know, for some time. And then I felt that it needed much more discipline, the work, and then I restricted it very much. And then later on I felt that I needed to make the arguments more specific. And the only way that, I mean, a lot of, say, the imagery in something like that can be, okay, so we read it, you know, we discuss it and read it, but it can be quite ambiguous. Therefore, I wanted to use language again to be specific, you know,
yeah.
To be articulate, or to try to be articulate, and also at the same time to break the hierarchy, you know, the hierarchy of the position of the artist as an elevated individual, if you see what I mean, separate and different. You know, the hero or whatever, and actually communicate on the same, across, as it were, while at the same time being able to be different as well, you know. I mean, I don't know whether I want my cake and eat it in that way, but, you know, to actually do something and then be able to talk about it or discuss or, you know,
yeah.
to feel that one can actually move in and out of that.
Well, it reproduces... a state of affairs that we were talking about earlier, where, you know, the work isn't finished or it doesn't achieve a particular pinnacle of any given
right.
point.
Right.
Someone coming into
yeah.
the work can, in a sense, participate in a building sense. You know.
Yeah.
Which is
that was particularly true in, I mean, I remember specific instances in A and B, you know, where. Yeah. Where there were people who came in and really played the game with B marvellously. I mean, just bloody marvellous. beyond the capacity for me to deal with it, really. You know, like they came and played around. It was marvellous, absolutely great. Because they took on the... They just, it was such a natural thing for them to do, you know, to take it on. And it happened with 10 days in, at Acme as well, you know, that Christmas thing. A lot of people did that as well. And I found that that reciprocal thing, very reciprocal activity, very, you know, it's energizing. You know, it leads to more things happening. It leads to the work becoming collective and me actually learning much more.
Is it something that preoccupies you, this notion of not wanting to now go out and make a so-called performance and spectacle, but to...
I thought it did, but I don't feel like that now. I seem to have sort of retracted from that a little bit. I don't know whether because it's too very difficult or whether... You know, I just don't have the same. Whether in having done that, you know, that I feel that is something that can be picked up again later on, if necessary. I don't particularly want to pick it up at the moment. I was really exercised by it, and I was thinking, well, you know, like this is actually a point at which, you know, I'm going to actually break with performance. I'm going to. One can no longer use the term. You know, one's actually destroying performance. You know, the notion of performance by doing this, and one will move into another area of some sort. And there's always that kind of ambition going on, you know, like to overcome performance because of its inbuilt restrictions. But now I don't feel that. You know, I feel that I could, I feel that I can work within. You know, within the limitations of performance of life, without feeling that is too restricting. At the same time, being conscious of that, you know, that issue, and maybe touching on it again, you know, in the work, but not in the same way, because I went straight at it in Montreal and in Rotterdam, straight, you know, like. Trying to hit right through it, and I just don't feel like doing that now. I think I'd like to try it another way. You know, I'd like to. I mean, certainly, I would like to be in a position where I could actually move beyond. I could get to a point where I wasn't actually making performances. I don't quite know what that means. I mean, you know, it's just recognition that performance has its limitations.
I suppose it also has a strength, which I presume is a positive thing in your case, where you are actually engaged in a very positive way with